morning. This is Hugh LaFolla, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Kristen Schrader-Bichette, professor of biological sciences and philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, and we're discussing Cass Sunstein's book, Risk and Reason. Kristen, glad to have you on the show.
Good to be here.
What if you could begin by giving the listener a brief summary of what you take to be the major claims that Sunstein makes in his book, Risk and Reason?
Well, Sunstein claims quite correctly that one aim of government policy is to protect people from inappropriate risk. And he says also quite correctly that most people are very poor at judging risk. Now, to correct this problem, he proposes what he calls the cost-benefit state. He proposes sound science. And he proposes turning policymaking over to technocrats and taking it out of the public domain.
Okay, very nice summary. I take it that you have some serious misgivings about the proposal, at least as it's presented in this book. I wonder if you could just briefly explain what those misgivings are, and then we'll go back and look at the elements of it in the remainder of the show.
All right. I have three sorts of misgivings. Number one, the author, Sunstein, claims to be doing science, and yet I can give dozens of examples in which the science that he cites is incomplete, wrong, in a variety of ways, often elementary ways. So I have scientific problems with the book. Secondly, I have problems with the book because it's biased. He omits many things, misstates positions, has a number of biases against citizens. He's very biased against democracy and lay people. I have a third set of worries, and namely ethical worries, and those have to do with the fact that he proposes turning over all decisions to cost-benefit balancing, and in the main, my ethical worries are he ignores the Bill of Rights, he ignores the fundamental things that this nation stands for.
Okay, let's go back and look at each of those. I mean, and I think each of them deserve a fair amount of elaboration in order to get clear about what your misgivings are. The first thing you said is that this book, although it claims to be based primarily on science, informed by science, you say it's not, in fact, what it claims to be. I wonder if you could give, again, maybe in general, some examples, and then we can look at each of the examples in more detail.
All right, I'll do that. Let me start with just a couple of examples. He claims to be doing science, and yet really doesn't cite any mainline biological, chemical, toxicological journals. Instead, he cites corporate think tanks like the Cato Institute or the Heritage Foundation or the American Enterprise Institute. Let me give you two examples of the science that he cites. He talks a lot about using benefit-cost analysis and judging how we should spend our regulatory dollars based on risk. But his scientific understanding of probability and statistics is seriously flawed in at least five ways. Secondly, he argues that we're very irrational, members of the public, and being worried about nuclear energy and using commercial nuclear fission. But he is just basically factually wrong in a lot of science that he cites in the nuclear case. So those are two good examples. I could also talk about economics or toxicology.
All right. Well, let's look at the first. You want to criticize the source of information that he uses since he's claiming to be science. Why? Maybe could you give a couple of particular examples, and why do you see this as such a problem? What's wrong with citing corporate think tanks and political scientists?
Well, the difficulty is if you're saying that members of the public are irrational and stupid in the ways they evaluate risk, then what you want to do is give scientific studies that show the members of the public are wrong. But he's not done that. Instead, he's given political theorists, he gives their claims and then cites them. Let me give you an example. When he is speaking and saying that members of the public irrationally oppose commercial nuclear fission, he cites the International Commission on Radiological Protection. And then when you check his footnotes, the footnote is a citation to John Graham, all of whose risk, a political theorist, all of whose risk studies have been funded by industry, like the cigarette industry and the oil industry and the chemical industry mainly, and you don't find any citation to the International Commission on Radiological Protection. Well, since I'm currently a member of a major committee of the International Commission on Radiological Protection, and since he doesn't cite it, I know not only that his claim is wrong, but that he tries to back it up by using a political theorist. So that's the kind of thing. And when you see enough examples like that throughout the book, it makes you think, gee, should I trust anything this fellow says if in the areas that I have firsthand experience, he's just flat out wrong?
Could you give a specific example of a claim he makes about the use of nuclear power, about what he's wrong?
Let me give you an example. Okay, he says on pages 85 and 95 that members of the U.S. public are just not too bright in being opposed to commercial nuclear fission, and he says France is more reasonable and is pro-nuclear, and he says that he supports market forces in making the energy decision. But he's just flat out wrong, because the French nuclear utilities are nationalized, and they've been nationalized because they are not profitable. And every year the French government forgives millions of dollars in debts that its nationalized nuclear industry runs up. So you find that Sunstein's wrong on two counts. One, he says that the French are rational in pursuing nuclear energy on the market, but he seems not to know, or whoever wrote the book seems not to know, that the French nuclear industry has been nationalized, which is the first point, and second, that it can't operate on a market and make any money. He also, thirdly, ignores the fact that if nuclear power were so safe, which he says it is, it's not clear why the U.S. government should put a liability on nuclear-induced losses that amount to about 1/50th of the total losses so far from the Chernobyl nuclear accident. In other words, if people are so stupid in being anti-nuclear, well then, why is it that the people are irrational if they know that, say, 98% of their losses in a worst-case accident would not be covered? It seems quite rational to fear something if the government is not willing to provide total coverage. Moreover, he says people are irrational in not being pro-nuke, but if you look at the most basic reports of the U.S. Department of Energy, commercial nuclear fission is the second most expensive source of electricity per kilowatt hour of any, more expensive than natural gas, more expensive than solar thermal, more expensive than wind, more expensive than oil, more expensive than coal. Only solar photovoltaic is more expensive than nuclear. So again, you say, well, gee, it sounds to me as if members of the public are making sound economic decisions, and that this man is making claims that the nuclear industry might make, but which aren't really defensible on scientific grounds.
Let's move to the second point that you mentioned. You said that his use of probability and statistics is flawed, and you, I think, particularly said in five ways. And this turns out to be pretty important, because so much of what he wants to say is based on judgments about the ways in which the public is misinformed in judging risks and probabilities, and the way in which experts get it right. So what specifically, can you give at least a couple of examples where he's made a pretty, what you take to be a pretty elementary mistake?
Right. He repeatedly says that members of the public are ignorant and stupid in thinking about risk because they disagree with the experts. But what he doesn't mention is that every single time uncertainty analyses are done of the expert studies, those studies show the experts are wrong by 4 to 6 orders of magnitude. I do a lot of probabilistic risk assessment. Those of us who actually crunch the numbers admit virtually all risk assessments are wrong by 4 to 6 orders of magnitude. So if somebody says the chance of a nuclear accident is 1 in such and such, if that's wrong by 4 to 6 orders of magnitude, that means it could be wrong by a factor of 1,000,000. The probability could be 1,000,000 times higher. He completely ignores the fact that what he calls science is nothing but guesses of experts, and those experts themselves admit that they're typically wrong by 4 to 6 orders of magnitude. Let me give you a specific example. The best risk assessment ever done by the U.S. government, headed by Norman Rasmussen of MIT, is called WASH 1400. Every single one of the risk probabilities in that government study, which came out of MIT, fell outside the 90% confidence bound. In other words, the experts said the risks were low, but every single one of the risk probabilities they gave was far higher than they said. Every risk fell out beside their 90% likelihood risk, and yet only 10% of their risk should have fallen outside that bound. So that means if in the best risk assessment ever done, the best U.S. experts, on their own admission, were wrong by 4 to 6 orders of magnitude, the members of the public are being perfectly rational in doubting those statistics. So he quotes the experts, but he ignores the uncertainty limits on their estimates.
When you say that the experts are wrong in judging risk, all the examples you gave were examples where they judged that a certain chemical, I suppose, would present the following sort of risk to the public, and that the risk was, in fact, much greater. Is it more likely that the mistakes are made in that way than the other way, that that scientists overestimate how risky a chemical will be?
Virtually all of current risk assessors are in the employ of the very industries responsible for the risks. That's why people who tend to work in a particular area of science and technology have what's called an overconfidence bias. Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in 2002 in economics, showed that experts were just as wrong about risk probabilities as lay people were because they have what he called biases, most notably overconfidence biases. They were overconfident in their own technologies. Now, in this book, Sunstein claims that the public is ignorant and the experts are right, and we ought to rely on the experts. But if Sunstein really knew his economics, he would know that experts are just as biased as lay people, and that cost-benefit is just as biased in its assessment of risk as our lay people. He completely ignores that fact and the best writing in the last 30 years of economics.
Okay, so would it be fair to say that the fact that it's not just that experts get it wrong, but they standardly get it wrong in that they judge that the risk is much less than it actually
exactly.
is going to be, that might give reason to embrace a principle which he rejects, and I think he calls it the precautionary principle, that basically you ought to assume that something is more risky than people think it is. And he says that he thinks that that's a mistake, but I take it, given what you said, that you might think that something like that principle would be appropriate.
Something like that principle would be appropriate if you just look at the empirical facts. I mean, look at the empirical facts that the U.S. government lied about the effects of U.S. weapons tests for 50 years. Millions of Americans have premature cancers because of fallout from above-ground weapons tests. Now, I support those tests. I think they're essential to national security. I don't support the government saying no one was harmed and then not paying the medical costs to help the people who were harmed. For 15 years, the National Cancer Institute covered up the health effects of those cancers because the government did not want to be responsible for the liability claims that would be brought by the public. Nuclear worker risk were covered up so badly in the United States by the United States that President Clinton in 1990 had to assume that all U.S. nuclear workers, 600,000 of them, received exposures at the highest levels simply because the records were falsified. So given the massive government cover-up and lies about relevant risk, it seems to me that reasonable people might say, gee, should I trust these people who've lied to me in the past about the risk?
Okay, so the two problems. One is that they may, in fact, in the attempt to do it well, may underestimate the risk. And secondly, they may know quite well what the risks are, but simply not communicate that to the public.
That's exactly right. For example, staying on nuclear power, just because this is one of Sunstein's favorite examples, he says that nuclear power is not risky. But he doesn't tell any of the readers in his book that the government itself estimated that the risk of a nuclear core melt in an existing U.S. reactor was 1 in 3. And that information is from the WASH 1400 document I cited. That statistic was covered up by the government and by the industry until a private group headed by Ralph Nader filed suit under the Freedom of Information Act, and Ralph Nader said, the people of the United States have the right to know the risk statistics that have been calculated using their tax dollars. And for 30 years, the government kept secret those statistics because they were so damning.
Now, I think that actually leads us quite nicely into the next concern that you mentioned, that you have ethical worries about cost-benefit analysis. It's not that you don't think that there's a place for cost-benefit analysis, I take it you do, but that you think that it ought to be constrained, as you put it, by the Bill of Rights.
Right.
Could you briefly explain your point, and then we can look at the elements of that in more detail?
Okay. Well, I want to make clear that I'm a strong proponent of benefit-cost analysis. I did a postdoc in economics, and I believe in benefit-cost analysis. I think anybody who ignores any analytic or scientific findings is just an irrational person. My problem with Sunstein's book is he uses cost-benefit analysis in such a way that he ignores the Bill of Rights. Let me give you an example. Suppose in your town there's a crime of passion and a murderer kills somebody. Now, I know from reading criminology that most murders, if you're not dealing with serial murders or mentally ill people, most murders are crimes of passion, and murderers almost never strike a second time. They're very safe people, and the chance that they will hurt another person is very, very, very low. Now, suppose using benefit-cost analyses on Sunstein's terms, I said, well, look, why should we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, $1 million or more, which is what it takes to bring a murderer to trial, because the risk that he's imposed on society is very small. He's only killed one person. The probability that he will strike again is almost zero. Why not spend our money on bigger risk, on the fact that, say, 300,000 people a year die in the U.S. because they don't exercise properly? Now, if you were a victim of that murderer, would you like to have the money that should have been spent on the murderer's trial spent instead to encourage Americans to exercise? That is essentially what Sunstein proposes, that unless you spend money to get rid of the biggest risks first, you're irrational. Well, my point is, hey, the Bill of Rights tells me I have a right to equal protection. Even if I'm one person and I'm the only one who dies, rights are not subject to a cost-benefit criterion.
Okay, when you say rights are not subject to cost-benefit criterion at all, or is it that they don't eliminate rights?
Sunstein would eliminate rights because he says again and again in his books, and I can give the page citation. It doesn't matter whether or not people consent to the risk. He even says that should not play a role. Well, the Bill of Rights says, and the Nuremberg War Trials Agreement say, nobody has a right to impose a risk on me at my expense and for his profit if I don't agree. So what Sunstein wants to do is to make benefit cost the test of all rights. And I want to say there are at least some rights, like the right to life, that ought not be subject to a benefit cost criterion.
Okay, and so, and consent matters in the example you just gave, because someone who does not exercise or have an adequate diet presumably does so because they choose not to do so. And
exactly.
To that extent, they've taken on the risk themselves, and that those risks then don't need to be as much of concern to the government and to others as would risks imposed involuntarily.
Exactly. And essentially, Sunstein's saying, well, look, if you're one of those, he even says, if you go to Haagen-Dazs or go to McDonald's and are overweight and impose a high risk of death on yourself, you're irrational if you blame me by making you breathe chemicals which subject you to a smaller risk. But the point he's missing is that somebody doesn't have the right to harm me just in case, you know, I do other things by personal choice that are riskier. And the reason why somebody else doesn't have the right to harm me is Sunstein ignores who gains and who loses. If I eat Haagen-Dazs and put myself at risk, I gain. If I get medical x-rays and put myself at risk, I gain, because maybe I need the x-rays to diagnose a cancer. But if I subject myself to toxic chemicals, I don't gain. The corporate polluters gain. So Sunstein completely ignores who gains and who loses. Instead wants to say, well, let's just get rid of the biggest risks first.
All right. The reason I asked the question earlier about whether they can be balanced at all, suppose that we discover that there is some new chemical that if we add it to drinking water, for instance, would in fact have fairly substantial benefits. And we'll even assume it's cheaper. But we also happen to know that, you know, one person in every 4 million people will react badly to this chemical, and they might die. Would, on your view, would that mean that we could not add the chemical if even one person might be harmed by it? Or would we make some kind of trade-off and say that the overall benefit to society would permit us to include the chemical in the drinking water?
I think you have to have some level of trade-off, because a zero-risk society is impossible. Right now, the federal government says that if something increases my risk of death by an amount larger than 1 in a million, if for everything, of every action the federal government does, if it causes more than 1 in a million people to die, then it should be regulated. I think that the government has a reasonable standard. That is not the standard Sunstein proposes. Sunstein says, so long as we face greater risk from ABC, like failing to exercise or eating Haagen-Dazs ice cream and being too fat, so long as we face greater risk from those things, we should not be forced to spend money on cleaning up toxic waste. Instead, we should spend the money on encouraging people not to eat Haagen-Dazs ice cream and encouraging people to exercise. He wants to make the numbers of deaths the ultimate criterion.
So you do agree that the idea that we can be risk-free is in fact silly, and if people want, if people want that, then they want something that's impossible.
Of course it's silly. And in fact, corporate polluters want to paint members of the public as being irrational and wanting a zero-risk society. I don't know anybody who wants a zero-risk society. They just don't want to suffer health consequences so that somebody else can make a bigger profit.
And that seems to me to be the real point of difference.
Right.
All right. In the last 4.5 minutes here, what I'd like to do, and you've already hinted in this direction anyway, is to turn and ask how you conceive the appropriate role of cost-benefit analysis in protecting individuals from risk, and how these other factors that you talked about that might be embodied in the Constitution and the amendments to the Constitution should play a role in helping us decide and shape what kind of environmental policy we would have, what kind of toxicological policy we would have, and so on.
Okay, well, my solution is basically the same solution as the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. And I want to point out that in this book, in which Sunstein proposes better science, he never once cites the Supreme Court of Science in the world, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, which is made up mainly of industry and corporate and academic scientists. In 1996, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences proposed a response to your question, and they said that cost-benefit analyses, expert analysis, should play an equal role with stakeholder deliberation, meaning we should take just as much account of consent, fairness, equity, as we take account of benefit-cost analysis. And they propose that every time we face a policy decision, we should have a joint team of experts and lay people, potential victims, making decisions about the risk. Because it's not merely a question of how big the risk is, but how voluntary it is, how equitable it is, how compensated it is. So that's essentially what should be done. And if Sunstein had cited the best science, he would have cited that alternative. Instead, the alternative he proposes is what is offered by industry, not by scientists.
All right, so the idea that you ought to have the stakeholder input is certainly an important contrast with his position, because he talks in several places about experts having the authority to ignore public opinion and even to ignore the votes of representatives of decisions about where money ought to be allocated, that if the experts are agreed that something is not as risky as most people suppose, or that the cost is worth it, that they should be able to just ignore public opinion. And
right.
And that, it seems to me, is something you emphatically want to disagree with.
Right, that's exactly right. Thomas Jefferson said it best of all. Thomas Jefferson said, if we think the people are too uninformed to govern themselves, the solution is not to take power from the people. The solution is to inform the people, educate the people. But I also want to say it's just flat out wrong to say that the experts say all these things that Sunstein says are not risky. Sunstein said there's no proof that DDT causes harm. DDT is in the polar ice caps. It's in mother's milk. It's caused hundreds of thousands of fatal cancers. He says benzene, formaldehyde, all these things are not harmful. He says nuclear power is not harmful. He constantly makes appeals to the experts, but then when you check his footnotes, all his experts are not from scientific journals. They're all from corporate-funded groups. So he makes an appeal to science on which he himself does not deliver.
Okay, well, that seems like a suitable conclusion to the interview. I really appreciate your appearing on the show today.
Thanks very much.
I've been speaking today with Kristen Schrader-Pichette, professor of biological sciences and philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. We've been discussing Cass Sunstein's book, Risk and Reason. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.